one of the problems that we often have is we start with the dactylic hexameter. And it's just much harder than learning a fixed pattern and saying that syllable there is going to be long no matter what, because syllable number 5 is a long syllable in Horace. Yeah. With the dactylic hexameter, you can't do that anymore. They have to play with the variability, and I think that can often lead to sadness. Well, one of the biggest things that the grammarians talk about is this pattern. And that pattern right there, long, 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 short, short, long. They talk about that as being a nice beginning, the first half of a hexameter. They also talk about that as being the beginning of Catullus's Elation Hendeca syllables. They talk about that as the beginning of all of Horace's Asclepiadeans. That same pattern at the beginning. This is their favorite collocation of different kinds of meters. They all match one another.
Does that have a name?
Sorry?
Does it have a name?
Well, they usually name it after the hexameter. They call it the hemiapase. Half epic line. And so it's usually named after the hexameter because that was considered to be kind of the queen meter. I go on from there. In fact, the grammarians talk about these two different theories of where meters came from. One theory is that everything came from the hexameter. And the other one is that there are 9 prototype meters, and everything came from those 9 prototype meters. There's a lot of fighting about that, too, which isn't that interesting. Does everybody have the hexameters now? Okay. This brings us back around to the beginning. I figured this handout, what I would do is try to come back to the earlier part where we talked about the raw material and the things the students need to start. The raw material and the syllables, they just have to be able to divide those syllables. If they don't know that, then they can't even get in the game, and so I think it's really good to explicitly start that. I think far too often what we tend to do is I tend to kind of get sad when they don't know stuff rather than just teach it to them. And I think I finally got over that after 25 years of teaching, saying if they don't know how to divide syllables, I guess I'll teach them how to divide syllables, rather than being cranky that they don't know how to divide syllables. So it's taken me a long time to get step number 1. It's actually a real part of it, but there it is, step number 1, the raw material. So I just divide it up. Number 2, the wrong material, they've got to do the long, heavy, short, light, and then the word shapes and the accents, and this again, it's important, I think, at step number 2, to keep emphasizing that this is part of the raw material. And there's nothing that has to be metrical yet at this point. That first word, bum di, that first word is trochaic, a long and then a short. That word is trochaic no matter where it's going to fall under normal circumstances. So it's part of the regular feature of the language. The accent's part of a regular feature of the language. And I think I keep trying to make sure that they get this, because then they can see it not as a, you know, some kind of artificial perversion, but as taking advantage of stuff you've got in the language. On number 2, you've got a nice staccato accent on canno, accent on the short syllable ka, which can give us a chance to review that with our students again. You've got the optional accent on qui, depends on whether you want to accent that monosyllable or not.
Can you read that for us, unaccented?
Read the line?
Yeah, because I don't really quite see how you can say that monosyllable is not accented, really.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, which brings up a good point about accents before I try that. A good point about accents is that there isn't anything absolute about them. It's just in relation to the words around. You very often get the measuring kind of linguists. I hope I'm not offending anybody. You get the measuring kind of linguists to say an accented syllable is this percentage, you know, more stress than an unaccented syllable. And yeah, okay. It really makes no difference except in relation to the other words around it. So if a word has a little added, you know, acoustic oomph in relation to the words around it, it's accented. If it doesn't, it's not. So there isn't anything absolute about it. So it just depends on how much added acoustic oomph you want to give to the qui. So I'd say armaverunque canno troiae qui primus aboris if I didn't. If I really want to emphasize it, I'd say armaverunque canno troiae qui primus aboris. I kind of exaggerated a little bit there, but the difference between just demoting it, the sotto voce, demoting it or promoting it in relation to the...
I mean, it seems like a negligible point to me.
It does. I think that, and that's why I do 2 things when I'm doing my handouts usually for class. I either do it like this where I put them in parentheses, Or I just accent anything that could be accented when I give out the handouts and say, you know, here's what W.S. Allen tells us. And the linguists all tell us that monosyllables may or may not have been accented, and then you decide. Very rarely will a student want to decide. Usually it's tell me, Dr. Becker, which way I ought to do it. But I think it does make a difference in the feel of the line. If I go arma virumque canno troiae qui primus abores, then I'm really hitting that relative hard. I'm really focusing in there. Whereas if I say qui primus abores, then my focus is on the stuff around it, the troiae and the abores.
Well, except that you're not giving the same length to the.
Yeah, that's true. I am shortening it up to exaggerate.
And so is that reasonable?
Oh, it's not. For the exaggeration, I should have made it longer. I mean, I shouldn't have exaggerated as much.
Well,
when
I mean,
you say
both are the same length, whether you accented or not accented.
Right, and I was shortening up in order to try to highlight the difference.
That's why I'm wondering, yeah. You know, how you can.
Well, I mean, I can say a long syllable without accent. I can say throw yai, and then I'm accenting throw, and my yai is still long. Throw yai. It's just a matter of a little more acoustic emphasis on the throw than the yai. So I think even in English, I think we can still make those distinctions, even though our poetry doesn't depend on them the way that their poetry does.
I mean, I don't want to take too much time on this, but words have a stress, as we've been saying, but phrases have a stress too.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, paper has a clear stress, and napkin has a stress, and holder has a stress, but paper napkin has a clear stress, where paper holder has a different stress.
Yeah.
So maybe it's that kind of thing.
Right. It depends on how, the phrase stress. There's a linguist named Ron Scollin who talks about phrase stresses. About phrase stresses that we pretty much lost them. The grammatici don't talk about them, so that's us more than them.
You know, I think one thing that I feel very strongly about in teaching prosody, it really is like music. I mean, if you think of letters as instruments in an orchestra, it's sort of like a conductor. I mean, there were performers of poetry. And, I mean, you look at Queen, you know, you want to emphasize, well, you've got three eyes there. You know, there's a beautiful assonance in that line. And the performer, you know, may have spontaneously just kind of thought, well, yeah, I never noticed that before. God, that is beautiful.
Yeah.
And, you know, in their own professional way, and like you, I'm not a performer, but I love to listen to people that can do it.
Yeah.
Because it brings out things that you don't hear when you're reading, and you really do need to hear, because it's part of what the poet is doing.
Yeah, and I think that's actually interesting in light of the way the ancients would have done it. We have there was an interesting paper given last year by some, a couple of years ago at APA, by someone who talked about the professional readers, the lectores, and how highly trained those professional readers were. So the professional readers were sort of trained to hear certain things and bring out certain things, and then sort of by extension the audiences were also trained to hear those things as the readers would emphasize different matters. But we don't have a lot of info left, which is unfortunate. Coming back to the phrase, though, the end of this line has one where the prepositional phrase would normally be treated as one together, aboris, treated as one word for the purpose of accent. And so this is an example where we do have evidence from Quintilian, who says prepositional phrases are treated as one word for the purpose of accent. And so you treat it as one word if the noun that the preposition governs follows it. If it's a noun and then some other stuff, I mean a preposition then other stuff, then it doesn't, then the preposition tends just to be on accent. All right, then the metrical pattern. And this is the abstract for the eye, kind of meter on the page, and that's the stage at which I always stopped when I was in college and grad school. We never went beyond meter on the page. So step three is sort of what we're used to doing, breaking it up, what the ancients called scandera versum. Armawi, rumqueca, no tro. Yai qui primus ab uris. So then you're breaking it up, measuring it on the for your eye. And then what I just did aloud is step four, which is what they would have done, the oral blackboard. They would have done it heavily emphasizing that first piece, the first necessarily long syllable of a foot, where the beat's going to come in the hexameter, and then making it sound like an artificial accent for those purposes. So armawi, beat short, rumque ca, beat short, no tro, beat long, yai qui, beat long, primusa, beat short, and then the end, odis, beat long. And I think this way you can help them begin to scan orally. If they can think in terms of a beat, you have a beat, and then you either have two syllables or one syllable. then you have another beat and you have two or one, then another beat and then two or one. And then once they can get comfortable with finding a short syllable, if you got a beat and then you know that next syllable is short, game over. You know it's got to be short, short, and then long. And so they can begin to let the sentence unfold rather than what I always did, which is work from the back. You know it's going to be bum diddy bum X at the end. Work from the back, work from the beginning, and see if I can make it fit as I would go back towards the middle. This way they can think in terms of acoustically, beat, and then, is the next syllable short? Yes. If so, then I've got short, short, and then beat. Is the next syllable long? Yes. If so, then that's that syllable, and then the following beat, boom, for the next foot. So they could, with a little practice, they can kind of get those feet all together. Yeah, Brian.
Do beats always have macrons on them, or do you teach some tricks to decipher where the macrons are?
Yeah, no, I don't, and it's those hidden quantity vowels that are tough, like ar, the A of arma, you know, is it a long or a short? Sometimes they can tell from the metrically with the other ones, but if your syllable is closed, if it's got a consonant at the end, you really can't tell whether that vowel is long or short. And I sometimes I do it if I have enough strength, and sometimes I just kind of let it go and say, you know, for sections that they're responsible for scansion and things, they just have to, or you have your big dictionary out here. They just have to keep flipping up and trust the long marks in the dictionary. Yeah, it is too bad that we don't have long marks. It would make my job a lot easier if all the texts had long marks. So, I mean, after all, we give them word spaces. Why not long marks? We give them punctuation for crying out loud. Let's give them some long marks.
All those crutches.
Yeah, really, it's not like we're going to end up with a bunch of degenerates. It does remind me, though, of some of you know the venerable cranky scholar Hugh Lloyd-Jones. In an elevator once at an APA on the way up, I was in the front trying not to be there. And he said, somebody got their quantities wrong when they were reading quotations as they were giving a paper. And he said, when I was in school, we were beaten for getting our quantities wrong. All right, down at the bottom of the page, versal sexameters, the raw material within the metrical pattern. So then the students, after they've done arma vi rum queca no pro jai qui primus aboris, then they can actually read it. Arma virum cacano, troiae qui primus aboris. They can read it through with the accents and feeling that undercurrent along there. Recently, people have been fussing a little bit about why qui is after troiae in some publications, because it ought to be up before troiae. And one of the ideas posited was that allows you to have an accent on away from a beat. And I really like it. I don't know if I believe it. But I think there could be a prosodic reason. Could be if you put qui troiae, then your accents tend to go with the beats in the middle. So we'll talk about that someday. Turn to the next side of the hexameter sheet. Is it the next page or is it the back of a page?
Next page.
One of the things that's fun to do with this is if you get one of the commentaries, and I think Austin's commentaries on books 1 through 6 are some of the best for this. He pays attention to sound the way that most others don't. If you can bring in these for the students, these metrical commentaries, and then show them something cool that happens. Now, here's the caveat. The caveat is then they start to think that everything important is when something cool happens. And if nothing cool happens, it's not important. But nevertheless, this is that sound and sense way. So this metrical comment from Austin on Aeneid 133, a line of extreme gravitas, slow and deliberate with only one clash of ixtus and word accent, erat. So for scanning this first, it would be tantae molis erat romanam condere gentem. And that wouldn't have anything interesting rhythmically to it, but then if you can get your students to see the erat, tantae molis erat romanam condere gentem, then you've got all of a sudden a little hitch in the middle. A little nice staccato accent in the middle that causes a little flutter of excitement.
Right.
As it goes through. All right. How about this next one? An unusual rhythm. This is Austin again on 1105. First he says the rhythm is notable. There's notable, and then he talks about coincidence and such. And then that line. In this abnormal line, because of the monosyllable at the end, there's clash, not coincidence. Such abnormality in Virgil is usually designed for some graphic effect. And I think that is probably true. If something is very unusual, it's there for an effect. If something isn't all that unusual, it can just be part of the acoustic patterning. But then such abnormality designed for some graphic effect. Here the mountainous waves rear up metrically. So you start off scanning first, and why don't we get everybody in on this? You guys want to just read heavily emphasizing those beats that are in bold. So on your mark, get set, go.
Dam latus in sequitur cum ullo praeruptus aquaemons.
Yeah. And so that heavily emphasizes the beats, but then when you do the accents, all of a sudden it's kind of difficult to say once you get the underlying pattern. So the accents, I'm going to do it first. Dat latus in sequitur cumulo praeruptus aquaemons. Ooh, I almost did it. I almost said aquaemons. So let me do that again. Dat latus in sequitur cumulo praeruptus aquaemons. Which sounds, yeah, it sounds a little bit awkward and interesting in relation to the metrical pattern underneath. But it's not at all awkward and interesting unless there is that metrical pattern underneath. How about Austin on 153? I love this. A fine line, that old British tradition of evaluating. A fine line indeed, showing metrically and linguistically the noise and straining of the imprisoned winds, the massive spondees, the struggle of, it sounds really exciting. The struggle of ictus and word accent all combined to form a memorable sound picture. So I'm gonna, I'll do the scansion on this one and you guys do the accents. Luctantis ventos tempestates que sonoras. Now, how about just with the accents? On your mark, get set, go.
Luctantis ventos tempestates que sonoras.
Yeah, so the first half of the line, you've got all this stuff going on that is really exciting to Austin and I think to all the rest of us. The last example there from Virgil, Austin on 6186, the ictus and speech accent clash strongly, he says. And this is another example where it's kind of hard to say because of those clashes. You have a couple of elisions there, or a protolision, immensant, and then silwimensam. So if I do it with the beats first, aspectan silwimensant sic forte precatur, and then with the accents, aspectan silwimensam, aspectan silwimensam sic forte precatur. And accented that sick, I think that's okay. So it's a little hard to say. And those are the places where the students can begin to get in the game because they can see that somebody says something cool about this line and you look at the line and if you can at least understand how it would have been cool, they don't need to feel like it's cool, but it's like a joke. They need to understand how it could have been funny and they don't need to think it's funny. Same way, they need to understand how this metrical pattern would have worked. And I put down a couple examples there that I just think are nifty. Horace, where he makes fun of his own line, doing it on purpose, when his hexameter line, when he says about producing mountains and a ridiculous mouse, he ends it with a ridiculous kind of metrical pattern on the last foot. So the beats would be parturient montes nascetur ridiculusmus. And then you end up with parturient montes nascetur ridiculusmus, which would have just sounded funny to his audience. So not just the monosyllabic moose at the end, but the ridiculous having an accent right there at that short syllable at the end, and then a moose, an accent on the last syllable, would have just sounded odd. One of the things we talked about briefly before was that when lines that scan themselves, sort of when every accent falls on a beat, it was considered inelegant because they thought the line just measures itself. Because either you don't have, there's nothing interesting going on, no accents falling elsewhere, it's exactly how you would scan it. And the line that Marius Victorinus always uses, one of the grammatici, and then everybody picked it up from him, is this line from Ennius. Everybody picks on Ennius. But this line from Ennius where every beat is a, every word is a foot, really every beat is an accent. Sparsis, hastis, longis, campus, splendet et horret. Just kind of blams along. And it's hard for me to believe that Ennius, you know, was kind of bumbling fool who did this by accident. I mean, if we had more Ennius, I think we would see how cool it was. But because we don't have a lot of Ennius, and because the ancients made fun of him, then this line ends up being a line that they consider to be inelegant because you don't have syncopation between accent and verse beat. It just scans itself as it goes along.